Session number 9856, Mr. Morian Morgan, part one.
Where were you born, Mr. Morgan?
In a small mining village called Anisabul.
Whereabouts is that?
4 miles north of Pontypridd, or about 20 miles north of Cardiff.
Which year was this?
1916.
What had your father done for a living?
My father was a collier.
How old were you when you left school?
About 18 or 19.
Had you gone to a grammar school?
Yes.
And what did you do when you left?
I then went to university.
To read what?
Initially English, French and history. And then later for my honours, I took French and Romance philology.
What did you do with it when you left?
Well, I didn't actually leave that then. In that final year, my honours year, I volunteered to go and fight in the Spanish Civil War.
Why did you do that?
I've got to go back now 50 years and try to imagine why I went there. My father was a founder of the Labour Party in Anisabul. And we as a family were all Labour in a very vague way. Although I had very little knowledge of politics, I remember when I was in the sixth form, we had an essay to do on the national government. And quite frankly, I knew absolutely nothing at all about what a national government was. And I had to ask my father what it meant. So my political views were very amorphous, simply feeling I was Labour, and that's all. Then when I went to university, I became involved in discussion in the common room. And it was that way, I think, that I suddenly found I had views on the world political situation. And then I became thoroughly involved in it.
Did you find that your views were in conflict with your fellow students?
To some extent only. They'd been in conflict, perhaps with other people whose views had been formed by their own family background, just as mine had been formed by being born in a Labour family. But I remember that at that period I was absolutely appalled by the fact that Mussolini was allowed to go into Ethiopia and attack it, and nothing at all was done by the League of Nations. And I was absolutely appalled too by the fact that his son Bruno Mussolini had written an article or a book in which he says that when he dropped the bombs on Ethiopian villages and all the villagers ran out into the fields, to him it was a most beautiful sight, like, he said, the opening of a rose. That appalled me. And then I spent a summer holiday, in the University of Strasbourg. And I often went canoeing on the River Isle and making trips to the Rhine. And there I was amazed at the number of soldiers I saw, and fortifications and cannons. It hit me like a bomb, because until then I'd lived in this village. We were never aware of military might whatsoever. At that age, you wouldn't be reading newspapers. Radio was in its infancy. And we were hardly aware of politics or military might whatsoever. Except maybe on occasions when we saw a member of the Welsh Guards returning home, fully dressed. And I remember when I came back, I'd won the prize essay for the year, and I was asked to contribute for the school magazine an essay. And I remember what I wrote about was Ethiopia and the rearmament going on in Germany. Then as I gradually learned more about it, I found that although Germany had been demilitarized after the First World War, she had been allowed to rearm herself, and even in fact to buy submarines and military equipment from British firms who were advertising in the German military magazines. Soon after this, Germany was able to invade the Ruhr and recapture the Ruhr, providing a fine industrial base for any military expansion. And then I felt a spirit of helplessness to see that this process was going on and absolutely nothing at all was being done to stop it. We had also seen the Japanese go into Manchuria and nothing at all was done about it by the League of Nations, except express pious platitudes about this, that, or something else. Then we saw Hitler go into Danzig and gain that. Then he was allowed to go into Czechoslovakia, and again nothing was done. And it seemed to me that the nations of the world were conniving with each other and with Germany to allow this process to continue. I'd studied history in Form 6, 19th century history, and I had a fairly good understanding, I thought, of the way in which the 19th century history was being continued in the modern day. By 1870, when Bismarck had unified Germany, nearly all the world had been shared out among the imperialist powers. Britain owned one-fifth of the entire world. France, Holland, Belgium, Portugal had shared out among themselves practically the whole of Africa, the whole of South America. Britain originally had North America, then large areas in the Far East. And Bismarck had said at the time that in view of the fact that the world had been shared out among the colonial powers, the only solution for Germany's need for living room, Lebensraum, was to go east, Drang nach Ostend, driving eastward toward the vast plains of Russia, which was about one-sixth of the world. And it seems to me that all the major powers were quite content to divert Hitler's attention to the vast area of Russia in the hope that he would then leave alone the colonies that we had occupied. And I was so very much concerned by this that I started a newspaper in college. I wrote it all under various names, pseudonyms. I typed it all out. I cyclostyled it, and I sold it. And the whole of the thing was devoted to international politics.
What was it called?
It was called Why Not?
Did we say which university you were at?
No, it was the University College of Cardiff. And I became very, very much concerned then with the position in Spain. I saw Spain not as merely another country being invaded by the fascist powers. I saw it as a testing ground for modern warfare. We'd already become aware of how Hitler had marched into the Rhineland, into the Ruhr, into Danzig, into Czechoslovakia. And I may be mixed up with some of these dates. I'm not sure the date of Czechoslovakia. And to realize that what he was doing there was to develop a new form of fighting. And he was practicing there. The First World War had been static warfare in trenches, thousands being killed for the sake of gaining a few yards of ground. And it seems to me that the Allies were adopting the same tactics again for the next war. This time it was a sort of Hilton trench warfare, whereby the French had their Maginot Line, and there they had all modcons, but it was still static warfare and dating back to the First World War, ignoring the fact that the bomber planes now were active, that tank warfare had been highly developed, and even then I got some bits and pieces of information about Spain, whereby they were using dive bombing, a thing unheard of in the First World War. And I could see that our generals were still refighting the First World War with the same technique, whereas the German generals had developed a totally new technique. At this time, I didn't know about the panzer movement, the swift encircling of a town. All I knew about was the dive bombing and the attempt to bomb civilian centers in order to demoralize the population. I became pretty well known in the common room for my political talking and political thinking. At this time, I was the chairman of the Labour Party ward in Annecy-Bull and had been involved in local elections, organizing them for councillors to get elected for the Labour Party. I was approached then by some people who asked me would I attend a political meeting in Cardiff in the Friends Meeting House.
What date are we talking about now, approximately?
We're now talking when I was in university. That would be around about 1936, perhaps. 1936 to 1937. And they took me to this discussion group where they talked about a political topic. I can't remember the actual topic. But they were all clearly very intelligent people and much more politically conscious than I was. My political views were very vague. They're not really associated with any particular party. I later discovered that these people were all Marxists and they were organizing things in the university, although quite frankly I never knew what they were organizing because they never showed their head above water.
Do you remember their names?
I remember one only. He was a doctor called, student training to be a doctor called Alistair Wilson. I know him because he was a doctor, he came from Aberdare, and was a doctor in Aberdare where I've lived for some 20 years. And I also know his wife and his father and his daughter. His father was quite progressive in a dilettante sort of way, and his daughter is quite active nowadays with CND and with organizing a support group for Nicaragua. And he was a communist, and they invited me to join the Communist Party, which I did quite readily. At no time did I find that my political views were in harmony with those of any political party. I prepared to join any party that was helping to do the sort of things I wanted to do. And these communists in Cardiff were quite anxious to raise help for Spain. It seemed to me that all they were doing, like the Labour Party in this country as a whole, was to collect little bits of material and articles for bandages and things like that, which I thought was very futile, that what they really needed was military help. During this time, I remember now, we had what is called the Non-Intervention Committee, arranged with the powers, whereby no help at all was given to the so-called civil war in Spain. This had the effect of preventing arms going to the government, but in no way prevented Hitler and Mussolini from sending all the arms they wanted into Spain. And when later on I volunteered to go to Spain, I saw evidence of their supplies everywhere I went. Well, I was very much concerned by this, and in this newspaper that I ran, I was tending to concentrate upon Spain. And then the time came when the fascists in Spain were approaching the outskirts of Madrid, and an urgent call went out for volunteers. Three of us decided to volunteer.
Who were the three?
I can't remember. One I know with a Scottish name came from Penarth, one of Swedish origin came from Cardiff, and myself. And we were told that in no circumstance should we tell anybody that we were going, because otherwise the police would stop us going. Well, the Penarth chap told his parents. They informed the police and he couldn't come. The Swede from Cardiff, he told his tutor, and the tutor persuaded him that he could do more good for the cause by staying here and conducting political activity rather than going to fight in Spain. And I suppose there was a lot of truth in that. And none of us were military-minded. None of us had military training. And quite clearly, we couldn't be a lot of use to the Spanish government.
Who had told you not to tell anybody?
I think it was the Communist Party, which was the only organization getting volunteers to go to Spain.
This was the Welsh District Committee, was it?
The Welsh District Committee, and the only man I knew there was a man called Len Jeffries. He is the one I talked to. And then, when I actually decided to go, I was told to meet an individual in a certain cafe in Cardiff at a certain time, a very small cafe. And there he gave me a ticket to London, and with instructions where to go in London. I can't now remember the name of the street, although occasionally I hear it on radio, mentioned in one connection or another. There in London, I was given a little money, a weekend ticket to France, a train ticket into Paris, and an address in Place de la République. I spent the afternoon watching a film. I think it is called The New Gulliver. Quite an entertaining film. Then I went across to France. Ah, yes, in London, I'd met a few other people, but we were told not to keep together when we crossed in the boat, otherwise people would be aware of the fact that we were going to Spain. In the same way, we should be together in the train.
By the way, had your parents objected to your going?
I didn't tell them. I didn't tell my parents, because I knew that if I were to do so, I'd be stopped almost certainly. My vivid recollection of La Place de la République is having tea in a basin. And then in this hall, there were hundreds of us together, and the police must surely have known you were there, with hundreds of foreigners, all congregating in the same place. Then again, the same thing happened. We had a medical examination. Then we were given money and a ticket to go on a train. And we were all being sent by different trains to the south of France. We were again warned not to talk to each other or to strangers. I think the station we left was La Gare du Nord. And I know that in the train journey, there was one man continually walking up and down. Now, whether he was somebody employed by the authorities to find out volunteers to Spain, or whether he was somebody appointed by maybe the Communist Party to ensure that everything was running smoothly, I don't know. But we got to the south, and I was then told that I was to get out and take the first taxi in the rank, and the taxi would take me to wherever I was supposed to go. The place I was in was called Carcassonne, and the driver then took me to the house of Joseph Verwerker, 59 Rue de Narbonne. Why I remember that, I honestly don't know.
Have you any ideas to the date?
I think that was just before the end of 1937.
What happened to you from Carcassonne?
We then spent 3 or 4 days in Carcassonne. I was not the only one in this house. There were other volunteers as well, although I can't remember their names. We stayed in that house for 3 or 4 days, never going out. I remember writing then some letters, which I wanted to send home to my parents, another to my friends, another to the French department in Cardiff, the department of the university, explaining why I was going. And I remember my own state of mind when I felt I could no longer study philology, when the whole world was coming to pieces, as I thought. I felt that once Hitler had perfected his technique, that there'd be no chance whatsoever of us ever living a normal life again. I don't make any claim to be a prophet, but I was overwhelmed by the urgency of this matter and felt I could no longer devote myself to pure academic matters when the whole world was going up in flames. It turned out that these letters, which I asked Mr. Verwerker to post, were never posted. I can well understand this, because to find all these letters addressed to South Wales would give the postal authorities a clue that houses in the town were being used for volunteers to Spain. Then, after 3 or 4 days, we were told that the bus would be coming to collect us that evening. We prepared ourselves and waited. Verwerker went to the door repeatedly, and his anxiety was clearly increasing as the time went by, because the bus normally would come at a given time and was rarely if ever late. So he became increasingly worried as midnight approached. Then finally he shouted to us, "Get ready," out he went into a darkened bus. And my most vivid recollection of that bus was the awful smell of garlic. Now, whether they were French or Spanish, I don't know. And I never did discover who the other people were. We just travelled in darkness for hours going south. When we came towards the Pyrenees, the headlights were dipped, or else he drove in side lights. But it was really a breathtaking journey. We couldn't see very much, but we had an impression of being balanced on the edge of a road which leapt down to canyons. And every so often we'd see a light flare up on the hilltop. And sometimes when this light appeared, the driver would slow down, then reverse and take a different route. And then it's quite weird to go down into a village and all we'd hear would be a dog barking. And then finally we came to a place and told to get out. Numbers of other buses had arrived at the same place. And then we were all issued with alpargates, Spanish slippers, cord-soled, with strings to tie around one's ankles. And then we had to walk up over the mountain. And we had to walk in silence in order to evade the attention of the representatives of the non-intervention committee. And I found this climbing one of the most arduous I'd ever done in my life. It seemed to be uphill all the way. And we really hadn't discovered the way of walking up hills. Most of us would try to walk fast by striding out, and this was apparently the wrong way. The only way to do it was by lowering your head, putting a hand behind your back, leaning forward slightly, and taking short steps. The chap who was guiding us over had already walked over from Spain over the Pyrenees that same day. And there he was now doing the same thing in reverse direction, apparently not feeling any difficulty at all, whereas the rest of us found it terribly hard. By this time we had all straggled out, and we'd stop occasionally for a rest, but by the time the tail end caught up, the front of the line was ready to move off again. Well, eventually we got over the frontier without mishap, and we all gathered round a small farm where we were given some coffee. Unfortunately, I was then overcome